my previous books are about not only about wildland fire, but they're about fatal wildland fires. And one of the joys of Home Waters is I've been able to talk about this and smile and laugh.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with author and journalist John N. McLean, who, in the spirit of his father's beloved A River Runs Through It, has written a chronicle of family and place. Reading Home Waters is akin to sitting down with a longtime family friend, perhaps in the comfort of a nearby river, to talk about that one time, an airing of family myths and mysteries. So, John, Home Waters is marketed as a story of family, yours, and a river, the Blackfoot. I'd love it if you read an excerpt from this book. The passage that I was looking at, it begins at the bottom of page 101. I'm wondering if you can maybe give a little context and then begin after parting from Clark at Traveler's Rest.
Oh, I'm happy to do that. You asked me to put in a little context about what this is all about. And it's about the Lewis and Clark expedition, and it's about the first white men to visit the Blackfoot Valley and record their thoughts. And they probably were the first white people. Clark Fork River is named the Clark Fork because it was thought that Clark was the first white man actually to be on it. The traders who were up in Canada may not have gotten this far down by 1806, which is when this happens. While Lewis and Clark were wintering over, they talked about the return journey, and they decided, although it's not well recorded in the journals, it is well recorded in their actions, that they would split up on the way back so that they could explore more territory, and so that Lewis, in this case, could make one final thrust to see if he could find a northwest passage easier than the one that they had come over that had nearly killed him on the journey out. So they got down to Traveler's Rest in the Bitterroot Valley, which has become a wonderful place to visit because just in recent years they have discovered signs of the encampment there and moved what they thought was the site for Traveler's Rest to a more appropriate place. And there's a wonderful interpretive center there. After parting from Clark at Traveler's Rest, the Lewis party crossed the Clark Fork and camped near a tributary, Grant Creek, on the outskirts of present-day Missoula. They spent the next morning, July 4th, at the campsite, sending out hunters and saying goodbye to the friendly Nez Perce, who had guided them over the mountains. The Nez Perce refused to accompany the party any farther, however, because they feared an attack by the Blackfeet. They warned Lewis he was heading into danger, but told him he would have no trouble finding the well-worn trail on his own. The party saddled up about noon and passed through today's Missoula. The party forded Rattlesnake Creek at about the place Broadway now crosses the Rattlesnake, at a bridge that has a plaque from the 1930s mistakenly claiming it marks the July 3rd campsite. They reached the confluence of the Blackfoot and Clark Fork rivers after riding 10 miles from camp and turned up the Blackfoot, following the trail on the north side of the river. Lewis recorded his first impression of the Blackfoot in his journal. He noted it was 60 yards across, turbid, and wide, deep, and rapid, the banks bold, not very high, but never overflow. Neither the Clark Fork nor the Blackfoot appeared navigable to him, in consequence of the rapids and shoals which obstruct their currents. For the first upriver miles, the river flows in a narrow gap between steep mountains that in places on the south side, opposite the ancient trail, come down to the river and make foot or horse travel impossible. Highway 200 offers an almost continuous view of the river along this stretch, which has become one of the most popular for float fishing. Lewis described this leg of the journey as poor land, timbered country, mountains high, rock, and but little bottoms. With few exceptions, the mountains are of sedimentary rock, part of the Precambrian belt formation, and easily break off in crumbly sheets. The effect is dramatically apparent on these first miles. Layers of shale at various angles from horizontal to straight up vertical rise above the river. The rocks, formed from sand and mud, were bulldozed into these shapes by a gigantic tectonic plate that geologists estimate moved east into Montana Territory 75 million years ago. Freezing, melting, and other effects break up the rock, which sloughs into huge fan-like piles that can block easy passage along the river. The explorers noted occasional rough going, but never once complained they couldn't find the trail.
Thank you. I love that passage, not only for the information that it presents to the reader, but it's so well integrated into this story. And I think your book, Home Waters, presents so much information and sort of, not disguises it, but kind of disguises it as a family history.
And there I really am glad you said that because I took a chance with that whole Lewis segment. It's long. And it's a part of the Lewis and Clark journey that doesn't get much attention, partly because not much happened. The reason I put it in was when I set out to write the book, I wanted to find out how all this started. I wanted to find out how the Blackfoot River got its name. Obviously, you got it from the Blackfoot Indians, but when did that happen? When did that become customary? Because in the Lewis journals, it's Kokalar-Hishkit, which is River of the Road to the Buffalo. When did that translate among white men into Blackfoot River? And what is the name? Because in my dad's book, and River Runs Through It, it's the Big Blackfoot. That is a nickname. And when you find the first reference to it by a fur trader, a trapper, he talks about it as the Blackfoot River and mentions the Little Blackfoot. You know, there's no connection between the two, no water connection. And I think that the reason they were connected, it was part of a fur trading and fur gathering route. You can get to the Little Blackfoot pretty easily from the Big Blackfoot. And so they had needed a different name for it because it seemed to them maybe that there was a connection. And I wanted to straighten all that stuff out because it hadn't been straightened in my mind. And then I got that done and said, well, what I've done here is rehearse the Lewis journals and add a little to them. So what I had to do to make it work for me in the book was to make it relevant, was to bring it up to date and talk about what you can find now. Where things are, that some of them are not at all well known, and what this has meant, you know, what it meant to have Lewis go through the Blackfoot Valley. It was the beginning of the end of the road to the Buffalo. It was the coming of the white man, the formal imprint coming of the white man. He saw things that white man had never seen before. It was the beginning of the end of the Plains Indian dominance in that part of the world. That happened at other places during the expedition, but it happened in the Blackfoot Valley in a particular way, and I wanted to record that.
Fly fishing and your family, which are, you know, at the heart of your book, at the heart of your father's book, they seem inextricable. In your father's novella, the line that opens the story is, "In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing." And I am not a fisherwoman myself, although my dad is, my sister is. I'd like to ask you maybe the simplest and maybe the hardest question. What's the appeal?
Well, you have to look at where it happens, I think, to start and set the scene for yourself. Trout live in beautiful places. They're fine-looking creatures. They're quite lovely. But the places that they inhabit are generally wilder, greener, cleaner, more peaceful, even before you get to the river or land of fish. So that's a big part of the appeal. Once you get into the act of fishing, you are connected to something that is mysterious in its own way, or at least I am and my family have been. You can't see the fish except in flashes. It's very powerful when you're on light tackle. The fish is within its own element. A big fish will know its own hole, where all the submerged rocks are, where all the structure is, and will lead you a merry chase and sometimes humiliate you, which is part of the game and a good part of it. You know, you shouldn't always be top dog. It's challenging in a lot of different ways physically. Talk about Paul going out and fishing the heavy water. I still bank fish the Blackfoot at my advanced age. I can't do what I used to do, which is put a bar of chocolate and some peanuts in my pocket and go out all day long, but I can still get out and do it. The sense of being part of something bigger than yourself has a lot of parts, and the fish and the river are part of it, the scene is part of it, the sky is part of it. Sometimes your companions are part of it. Sometimes it's a transporting relationship with people who are with you beyond words. So there can be an awful lot to it. I'm not saying all those things happen every time, because they don't. But some of them happen most of the time, and when you're lucky, a lot of them do.
You mentioned your Uncle Paul. Was Paul McLean a humble person?
Paul McLean was an interesting person with a lot of problems, which he did not solve very well. He has been a figure in my life, my entire life, and still is, obviously. I don't think that there would have been A River Runs Through It written without him, or my father's other book. I probably wouldn't have gotten into, I certainly wouldn't have gotten into the kinds of books that I have, and would not have written Home Waters. But that's his afterlife. That's his legacy, and it's a very fine one. His life was a troubled one. He was a positive example to me. As a newspaper man, I became a newspaper man. He was a positive example, if an impossible example, as a fisherman. I used to wonder, you know, we talk about this guy, he was the greatest fisherman, and he was this and that. I said, oh, where is he? You know, why can't he stand up here on the river with me? And I find out just how great he is. And maybe I have a day or two when I do a little better than he does. I'm not sure that would have happened, but it would have been nice to have him there. But he was also a negative example. He had gambling problems, drinking problems. I mean, I don't want to go into it too much. I dealt with his death factually in Home Waters because there's so much nonsense talked about it. Trying to create it as some meaningful, romanticized, mystical thing. I don't think it was that. I think it was what I portray in the book. But the afterlife he's had is very important. I just mentioned the books. That's a big deal. Secondly, what's in the books is a big deal. A lot of letters have been written in fan mail to my father or said to me from people who had a wayward sibling. And they gave of themselves, offered something of themselves to a brother or a sister to try to help them and were refused. And they felt desolate. And suddenly they have this book, A River Runs Through It, that raises their pain to a very high level and at an eloquent level and offers compassion and a sense of community. And that has been a theme and an underline a lot of A River Runs Through It in the 45 years that it's been out. It hasn't gone away. It still comforts people. That's because of Paul.
So he may not have been a humble person, but in the book, you do call him tender. In a chapter titled When the Mountains Roared, you wrote that he could never bring himself to shoot a deer, even though he handled a shotgun with assurance. You write, tough and tender, those McLean boys, down through the generations. Down through the generations. John, what about you is tough and tender?
Well, I don't know. Somebody else ought to say that. You know, they talk about this book as a memoir, and I don't call it a memoir. I call it a chronicle of family and a river. Mm. And I don't call it a chronicle of a family. And I had this discussion with my editor. He said, why don't we just call it a memoir of a family and a river? Because that's what it is, and everybody will understand that. I said, well, a memoir is about me. And there is a lot of me in this book, but that's not my primary focus. My primary focus is to chronicle how a family, and larger than the McLeans, also includes the Burns and the Kronenbergs and others unspoken, how they came to the West as pioneers and how it has changed and evolved over now more than two centuries. And to me, that's a chronicle rather than a memoir. So am I tough and tender? Well, I leave that to those who know me.
If If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with author and journalist John N. McLean, author of Home Waters. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Because we are recording this conversation the Friday after Father's Day, I want to talk about your father, what he was like as a father, maybe not about the way he was a writer or a teacher, but the way he was a father to you. What was he like?
Well, he was a wonderful man to fish with. And he was kind of a different personality in Montana than he was in Chicago, I think. He was a very accomplished professor of English at the University of Chicago and a great teacher. The University of Chicago valued scholarship and science, and he was not a top-flight scholar, and he was not a scientist, but he was a great teacher. And so you said, apart from being a writer and a teacher, what was he like as a father? Well, as a father, he was like a writer and a teacher, as well as a father. I mean, he never stopped wanting to be a writer, and it ate at him, and it came out fine in the end, but look how long he waited on that. I mean, River Runs Through It came out in the year that he turned 74. Now, I've waited, too, but I didn't stand around waiting. I started writing professionally 60 years ago. And have been writing books for 25 years. However, Home Waters has come out in a year when I've turned 78, which is older than my father was. And I hope somebody does a job sometime of trying to figure out why that happened. Somebody other than me. I mean, because I can't remember, I don't know of any similar parallel. Let's see, he was different things at different times as a father. During World War II and the aftermath, he was heavily involved in civilian war efforts. He was part of the NRA. He was working on a book on how to read a map. It was more complicated and a little more sophisticated than that, but that's what it was. And he was the dean of students. And he gave himself an ulcer. I mean, he was just working all the time. Then in the middle years, he was my father in Montana. I mean, in Chicago, you know, he would go to work and my mother would go to work and we'd have a normal family life. But what has stuck with me has been the way he operated in Montana. And it was layered. You would run into these layers like severe weather layers where, you know, it's hot one minute and cold the next. He would be living in 1920 one minute. It would just hit you that, you know, he was suddenly back working for the United States Forest Service, sawing logs. One of the things that he and I did together that we both just loved that wasn't fishing was to get on both ends of a two-man saw and cut firewood. And he was just delighted that I could learn how to do it. It's tricky. You pull, you don't push. You have to get this thing going in rhythm with your partner. You have to be connected to your partner. And you can make a two-man saw sing. It's this metallic music when you're doing it just right. And it is wonderful. But there were things like that where this was the life of Montana that he was recovering after being in Chicago. And that's what I identified with more than anything else. So there's a lot going on in Chicago. I mean, you know, he was a big-time teacher, and students loved him, and he had a reputation in the university, and he made it over this big hump of not being a producer of scholarly material. They say publish or perish. He wrote a couple of long pieces on Shakespeare for a book, Critics and Criticism. And then he looked at it and said, I'm not going to do any more of this. The world doesn't need another long story about lyric poetry. But he wanted to write. So he would write letters. to friends. That became very important. Write a big Christmas letter. That was important. He would, when the occasion offered, write a eulogy for a friend. And then he would read them to us. And suddenly you're back in the 1920s with the Reverend McLean. And, you know, he expected that kind of attention, as though he were the minister delivering a sermon. And it was very demanding. And I didn't quite understand why, except that he wanted that and was disappointed if you couldn't come up to that and become totally engaged with whatever it was that he was declaiming. And it was declaiming. That's what he did. And he liked to stand up in front of a class and talk. That was being like his father. He then established his own identity apart from Montana and his father, and it was very, very hard for him to do. I was thinking of that this morning. I've been at the cabin at Seeley Lake, and how overpowering the atmosphere was when Norman was growing up. That his father was a big-time minister in Missoula, took the whole thing very seriously, very demanding. How did he break away from that? How did my dad break away from that? I think it took a gargantuan effort to establish himself individually without losing his father, because he never lost the Reverend. So he was different things in different places. But he used to sign his letters as ever Norman, and that was part of him too.
He used to sign his letters to you as ever Norman?
Yes.
So he was not dad to you, like in those moments, it was
Norman.
Well,
if you read the book, sometimes he's my father and sometimes he's dad and sometimes he's Norman.
And that was one of my questions, right? Like, there is a distance sort of in the book often, and most often you refer to him as Norman. There are only a few references to my father. Why is that?
I think it's accurate. My father was a public figure in a lot of ways before A River Runs Through It came out, and treated himself as Norman. I will tell you that I tried calling him that to his face once, and it was a complete disaster. I mean, that wasn't what the relationship was when we were together. He was my father, his dad. Mm-hmm. But in thinking about him, especially at my age, yeah, I'll call him Norman when he's behaving like Norman, and I'll call him my dad when he's behaving like my dad. And there's, you know, there's some stuff in there that's real close. I mean, the first fishing trip he ever took me on, I'll tell you, I couldn't write that story for about 25 years. When I started writing books, I come out here to Montana and spend time at the cabin months and months and months. It was a very lonely time. And one thing I would do would be go back to the place that happened and think it through, which is why that scene in the and anecdote in the book is so vivid. It's because I've gone over it so often. And then I go back to the cabin and say, well, all right, now I remember that. I'm going to write it all down. And I couldn't do it. And finally, when I was doing the book and I came to a place in the book where it would be appropriate to talk about the first time you ever fished with your dad and caught a fish, I said, well, you know, I'm a newspaper man, or was, and I know how to handle a deadline. And I sat down and did it. And whatever it took. That's a very intimate story. In some ways, that's my favorite story in the whole book.
John, Home Waters is in part a departure from your previous books, most of which are about fire and wildland fires. Wildfires do make appearances in this book. You write about water and fire with such reverence, though, about both the Blackfoot River and the wildfires that have ravaged the state. I guess my question, if both river and wildfire, if both water and fire have family significance to you, I'm wondering, how do those writing processes differ? What's the difference for you between writing about the Blackfoot and writing about wildfires?
Yeah, it's night and day. But night and day are part of the same pattern. My previous books are about not only about wildland fire, but they're about fatal wildland fires. Where undeserving young people are burned to death. And one of the joys of Home Waters is I've been able to talk about this and smile and laugh And that's tells you the difference between my former books and this one. You can't talk about Fatal Wildland Fires and smile and laugh. The styles are very different. I think I've always had the style of Home Waters. I mean, I look back at the stuff that I wrote 30 years ago, and some of it is right in here. And I've been able to do that. You can't do that kind of thing, or I can't, with straight nonfiction. When I set out to write my first fire book, Fire on the Mountain, I knew it was going to be compared to Young Men and Fire. For one thing, I was writing about a fire that was a mirror image of the Man Gulch fire that my dad wrote about. Almost the same number of people were killed or smoke jumpers killed on South Canyon, just as there had been in Man Gulch and so on. And I was going to be compared automatically. And I thought about this. And I said, you know, I can't do what my dad did here. I can't inject myself into this story because when I was 16 years old, I was a punk kid trying to fight a fire, didn't know what I was doing, and somebody punched me in the nose, and that saved my life because I got out of the fire. That's what happened to my dad. And he would tell that story all the time. I heard that over and over again when I was a kid. And it's in a prologue to Young Men on Fire. I said, why should I try to be like that? Because I will fail automatically. Why don't I try to be like me? I've been a newspaper man for 30 years. I'm a journalist. And I deliberately took my what might have been a higher style down to a very straightforward, no frills, plain storytelling. And I got criticized for doing that a little bit. But that book has stood the test of time. It came out in 1999, so what's that, 22 years. It's still around. It is a standard among firefighters. People go back to that and reread it. Young people are encouraged and in some cases required to read Fire on the Mountain. It is not the kind of companion book to Young Men and Fire that Home Waters is to A River Runs Through It. It's a very different take. I could have gotten into it. I could have gotten into my dad's book. At one point on the South Canyon fire, when the fire was starting to blow up, a smoke jumper who happens to live in Missoula by the name of Quentin Rhodes was watching it. And he said, and it was quoted in the official reports, we're going to have to resurrect Norman McLean to tell this story. He said it at the time. It's in the official investigation report. I talked to him about it, and he said, yeah, I said that, and you can use it. And I thought about it and thought, if I put that in my book, I'm going to have to explain who Norman McLean is because he wasn't as famous then as he is now. I'm going to have to explain who I am, why I'm doing this, and get into something very personal. And, you know, even in Home Waters, I don't particularly writing personal stuff. Once in a while, I do. Like, first fishing trip with my old man. Yeah, I loved writing that. And some other stuff. But that isn't me. I mean, I spent 30 years trying to keep myself out of stories in the newspaper business. So I left it out. And today, if I were writing that book, I would put it in because it would be easy to explain. So that was one way of establishing myself as an independent writer, which I think I did.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, Lauren. Thank you for having me.
Look for more information about John at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Ostein. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.